You now have 1 minute to read the questions. The recording will then start automatically and play once. You cannot pause, rewind, or fast forward the recording.
I arrived in Toronto at the end of 2008. I had migrated from Nepal. It took a while and a lot of hard work to get my bearings. I studied at first before starting work as an educational assistant. By the time my wife and children were preparing to join me in 2010, I was ready to rent a small apartment. After years of living precariously, our family was finally reunited and settled, part of a community. Our home was in Parkdale, an area with many immigrant communities. It's also close to the city centre and the increasingly desirable lake shoreline. By 2015, property prices in the area had started to increase. With wealthier people arriving, landlords spied an opportunity to increase their profits. In early 2015, our landlord informed us that our rent was going to increase. Our tenancy agreements, as well as local legislation, cap rent increases at 2% a year unless landlords make major capital investments in the property. So ours did some renovations in the lobby. Then we were told our rent would increase 5% annually for the next 3 years. I couldn't afford that. It would make living in my much-loved home impossible. After talking to my neighbours, it was obvious I was not the only one who would struggle. Similar things were happening to tenants across the neighbourhood. Many of them were immigrants like me. People who didn't understand their legal rights or felt too afraid or unable to stand up for themselves. That, I think, was part of their plan. Clear out the residents who had lived here for years and bring in wealthier demographic. Thankfully, I knew about a community group of volunteers called Parkdale Organise. There was talk of coordinating a response to what was happening. A group of us identified 25 to 30 buildings facing similar issues. We set about visiting all of them. Our pitch was straightforward. We would ask about their situation, share information about their rights, and encourage them to join us. What we found was shocking. Some buildings were infested with cockroaches and mice, others had leaks, mould, or broken windows. Some were putting up with awful conditions, yet their landlords had failed to act. Something had to be done. We started to organise. Representatives from every building met regularly to strategise. Our demands were simple. All homes must be made suitable for human habitation and unaffordable rent increases had to stop. Soon, we were ready to launch our campaign. We spoke to local media, marched in the streets and worked with lawyers, but we were still ignored. We needed to speak in a language that would make these landlords listen. In May 2017, we took our fight one step further. By now, we were a network of hundreds of households, so we started a rent strike, each of us withholding monthly payments until our conditions were met. 3 months later, the landlords agreed to negotiate. At first, they offered to create a temporary fund for tenants who needed financial support. That wasn't good enough. All the buildings rejected it. Soon, the landlords were forced to renegotiate. There were cheers when we heard they'd conceded. While the settlement varied from building to building, we'd succeeded in our mission. The new proposals included no rent increases above 2% for 3 years for all tenants.
Do not press continue until you are ready to move on to the next section of the test. You now have 1 minute to read the questions. The recording will then start automatically and play twice. You cannot pause, rewind, or fast forward the recording.
Morning, Becky. I haven't seen you in ages.
Yeah, I've just returned to the office after taking some annual leave.
Oh, right. Going anywhere nice?
Yeah, we had a good time. But listen, the boss has tasked me with designing a notice about hand washing.
Right.
Well, what do you make of it? She's dictated the notice as follows. Wash your hands, shake them into the sink 12 times, grab a paper towel, fold it in half one time, and use it to dry your hands. Don't you think that's weirdly specific? 12 times, fold in half one time.
Yeah, it certainly has patronising overtones.
Or even antagonistic. I'm convinced I would deliberately shake my hands 11 times or 13 times.
And create an origami swan out of the paper towel.
Yeah, but there's another issue.
Go on.
Well, she instructed me to install the signs over the wash basins.
Yeah, logical.
Is it though?
Yeah, of course. People go to the sinks to wash their hands.
You've hit the nail on the head. The employees who see the notice are already at the sinks washing their hands. We'd be preaching to the converted.
Oh yeah, hadn't occurred to me.
It's the number one rule of notices, position them to catch the attention of the offenders, as opposed to the cooperators.
But do you believe this notice will be effectual? Maybe everyone will ignore it. Or perhaps it will inspire a few people, but not the multitudes. Or maybe it does appeal to the masses, but the effect is later curbed because the novelty wears off. Or, and I suspect this might be the case with this notice, it actually backfires. Due to its condescending nature, our colleagues might feel insulted by the imposition of how many times they should shake their hands.
Did you know that researchers at the City Hospital discovered that the hand hygiene compliance rate among doctors was only around 60%?
You jest.
Nope. And in a healthcare environment, that's a big deal due to bacterial infection.
So how did they encourage the doctors to increase their rate of hand washing?
The boss has distributed a memo.
That's preposterous. I'm assuming that approach had no impact.
Correct. Though at least it didn't have the adverse effect of decreasing compliance.
So then what method did they attempt? Reverse psychology?
Something more rudimentary. The bigwigs adopted the rather puerile approach of hiding in the doctor's room and waiting for them to come in and either wash, or fail to wash, their hands. Again, a bit old-fashioned and also a bit crackpot, if you want my opinion. And their initial plan was that as an incentive, they were going to use a stick rather than a carrot.
Meaning?
Publicly shame the doctors who didn't sanitise their hands. But unsurprisingly, the doctors were rather unappreciative of that kind of admonishment. So they changed tack and offered a carrot instead, in the form of a $10 Starbucks voucher for the doctors who had washed their hands.
That doesn't sound very sustainable.
No, especially when some smart aleck doctors played the system and invested their precious time in dashing into different rooms, continually hand-washing in an attempt to collect as many vouchers as possible. It became a competition.
But the incentive worked.
Well, overall, no. There were limited nooks and crannies where the authorities could hide. So after a while, it became obvious to the physicians whether or not the spy patrol were concealed in their offices. The head honchos began to feel concerned that they would have this grubby problem in perpetuity. But what did finally do the trick was a novel, out-of-the-box approach. An epidemiologist got a petri dish, you know, the little dishes you can grow bacteria on a culture in a lab. She arbitrarily chose a doctor to place their palm on the petri dish and sent it off to a lab. Evidently, the palm print was absolutely teeming with bacteria. She put an image of the scary-looking, worrisome bacteria on the screensaver of every computer, annotated with a message informing all the staff that this bacterial jungle was festering on the hand of a randomly selected doctor in their hospital. And that, ultimately, was the winning solution.
I think you'd get the best result by designing a notice that announces, "Just think how proud your mother would be to know that you're going to wash your hands now."
Excellent advice, John. I knew you were the go-to person to help with this.
Do not press continue until you are ready to move on to the next section of the test. You now have 1 minute to read the questions. The recording will then start automatically and play twice. You cannot pause, rewind, or fast forward the recording.
Speaker A. I live in a modern city centre apartment. It's very small, compact, let's say, and I have to be ingenious with space-saving ideas. It has one bedroom, a bathroom, and an open-plan living area and kitchen. However, it is really convenient because I'm close to all the amenities of the city. I can even walk to work. It is expensive for its size, but that's down to the location, and I save money on transportation because I don't have to commute. I have a small balcony, so still have an outdoor space, even though it's tiny. I'm on the 12th floor, so I have a bird's eye view across the city, and it's actually quite peaceful at this altitude.
Speaker B. I reside in a beautiful home in the countryside. It's a spacious, detached cottage comprising of 5 bedrooms, 4 bathrooms, a kitchen, dining room, and 3 separate living areas. It's very characterful as it's about 300 years old and built from stone. A house like this isn't cheap to purchase or to maintain, but it's worth it because I adore it. I have a large garden and grow some of my own fruit and vegetables. There are numerous trees and a large lawn. There are no neighbours in the vicinity, so it's very tranquil. It is also a little remote, however, so I do have to use my car for any chores.
Speaker C. I live in your typical suburban family house. 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, a kitchen, diner, and a living room. It's just about big enough for our family. We have a small garden out the back that's mostly used by the kids to kick a ball around. We're terraced, so we have neighbours either side of us, but we get on well with them. The area has a nice community feel to it, and the location is quite convenient as I can walk to this train station to get to work every day. There's also a corner shop nearby to pick up essentials. Though for a bigger shop, I need to drive to the out-of-town supermarket.